Welcome, Bankless Nation, to this very special Saturday morning edition of the Bankless Podcast. Every once in a while, me and my buddy, Anthony Cezano from the Daily Gway, we just hop into a live stream, no agenda, and just chat about the current events. There were a lot of the current events to talk about. I think you can know what we begin with. And so we just kind of recap the Terra ecosystem, but we do change subjects eventually after about 30 minutes and go into the merge. And if you have not watched the HAL press interview that we did earlier this week, it was extremely bullish, so we talk a little bit about that. I give it a quick TLDR, although it is not to be missed. And then Eric Connor decides to hop into the stream. And so Eric Connor from Into the Ether, longstanding Ethereum community members might recognize him, comes and finishes off the last third of the show. Really fun conversation, really enjoyed it, tons of fun, tons of energy. I hope it is a nice thing to chill and relax to after kind of a down bad week. But hopefully we can all shrug it off together. And so I hope you guys enjoy this fun, very fun conversation right after we get to some of these fantastic sponsors that make the show possible. If you're trying to grow and preserve your crypto wealth, optimizing your taxes is just as lucrative as trying to find the next hidden gem. Alto IRA can help you invest in crypto in tax-advantaged ways to help you preserve your hard-earned money. Alto Crypto IRA lets you invest in more than 150 coins and tokens with all the same tax advantages of an IRA. They make it easy to fund your alternative IRA or crypto IRA via your 401k or by contributing directly from your bank account. There is no setup or account fees, and it's all you need to do to invest in crypto tax-free. Let me repeat that again. You can invest in crypto tax-free. Diversify like the pros and trade without tax headaches. Open an Alto Crypto IRA to invest in crypto tax-free. Just go to altoira.com/bankless. That's altoira.com/bankless and start investing in crypto today. Aave is the leading decentralized liquidity protocol, and now Aave V3 is here. Aave V3 has powerful new features to enable you to get the most out of DeFi, including isolation mode, which allows for many more markets to be launched with more exotic collateral types, and also efficiency mode, which allows for higher loan-to-value ratios, and of course, portals, allowing users to port their Aave position across all of the networks that Aave operates on, like Polygon, Phantom, Avalanche, Arbitrum, Optimism, and Harmony. The beautiful thing about Aave is that it's completely open source, decentralized, and governed by its community, enabling a truly bankless future for us all. To get your first crypto collateralized loan, get started at Aave.com. That's Aave.com. And also check out the Aave Protocol Governance Forums to see what more than 100,000 DAO members are all raving about at governance.aave.com. The Layer 2 era is upon us. Ethereum's Layer 2 ecosystem is growing every day, and we need bridges to be fast and efficient in order to live a Layer 2 life. Across is the fastest, cheapest, and most secure cross-chain bridge. With Across, you don't have to worry about the long wait times or high fees to get your assets to the chain of your choice. Assets are bridged and available for use almost instantaneously. Across bridges are powered by UMA's optimistic oracle to securely transfer tokens from Layer 2 back to Ethereum. A token proposal is being deliberated as we speak in the Across forum, where community members will decide on the token distribution. You can have your part of Across's story by joining the Discord and becoming a co-founder and helping to design the fair launch of Across. If you want to bridge your assets quickly and securely, go to across.to to bridge your assets between Ethereum, Optimism, Arbitrum, or Boba networks. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Hey, man, what's up?
Survived another week. How about you?
Yeah, survived another week. I think my brain didn't survive the week, though. I don't know about you, but I am feeling very mentally exhausted, for sure.
What's doing it to you most? Just like Twitter doom scrolling? Usually my doom scrolling I do on Instagram, not on Twitter.
Really? Instagram doom scrolling? That's the thing. My Instagram is just like random pictures of kind of like computers, watches, and cars. So it's not doom scrolling. It's kind of like wealth scrolling, maybe, I guess.
poor timing, dude.
That's really poor timing. I think what did it to me most was just the speed at which it happened. Yeah. Right. We basically ran through like a crypto's 2008 moment in like 3 days. It was just insane. Right. And I think that's what fries my brain the most is when it especially happened during like DeFi summer a lot, when things would have just happened really, really quickly. Right. And you spend like all this mental energy trying to keep up and just catch up. And then you would just get like completely blown out by it. And then you do it all again the next day. Right. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's just the speed of it, I think, for me.
Yeah, it just reminds me of like the classic line when people are hungover and they're like, "I'm never drinking alcohol again." And then a week later, there's just like another farm to like ape into. Like that's what DeFi summer felt like. If we're doing the whole like crypto is speed running the history of money and finance thing, we just like sped ran like had hyperinflation event. Right, we went through like usually hyperinflation events take, they can take months, right? But this one took like 36 hours. Like we did just like Weimar Germany in like 36 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what I think shocked a lot of people. It was like, a lot of people called this and kind of like had been calling it for a long time, but I don't think anyone expected it to unwind as fast as it did. Like it literally went like, the Luna token went down like 99% in 24 hours or something. That was just insanity, right? And it wasn't just like some small shit coin either. It was like, it was worth tens of billions of dollars. It was a top 10 coin. And then it just collapsed. And everyone's just like trying to keep up with it. They're trying to keep up with kind of like, I think they're in disbelief because they're trying to actually process the fact that this is actually happening. Like this is actually happening. This is not a meme. Like this is not kind of some dream that everyone's having. It's an actual reality that we're all going to have to adjust to. And of course that bled into the wider markets. It wasn't just Terra, like everything came crashing down. And then people were trying to short the other stable coins, which was like peak stupidity. I was like, what the hell? Like, what is this? So yeah, just absolute insanity, man. Seriously. I think that I'm still going to be processing this for a while. I mean, it was my craziest week in crypto. I don't know about you, but definitely I haven't felt like that before in crypto.
Yeah, I was thinking about that question. Is this a craziest week in crypto? And it definitely is in a like catastrophic sense. I would say that like crazy as in just like I'm having to process so much with still DeFi summer. But barring that, which is like a completely tangential thing. I would say like this had like the most amount of just like news per hour of any single week. And comparing it to like last year's cycle, like oddly also in 2018, right? Like 2018, the downside of the peak mania, halfway through 2018 ish is when BitConnect blew up. And like, I think BitConnect was a top 10 coin, like at one point in time.
It was.
And it went to absolute zero at some point in time. And it took basically like 36 hours. But like the reason why no one really cared about that, well, people cared, but we all just expected it. Everyone was like, BitConnect took way too long to implode. Like it made people like question reality, is like, why hasn't this thing imploded yet? And then one day there was some bad news and 3 days later it went to zero. And so like the pattern fits, and it was a top 10 coin and then it just went to zero. And it was $3.8 billion market cap when it went to zero, which just, tells you how big the crypto market has gotten in the last cycle. Because if, like, Terra was also a top 10 coin, it went to zero, and it was something like over $42 billion at the time Luna was. And so, like, the scale of the thing is, like, proportional to the crypto markets, as in, like, the crypto markets allowed BitConnect and Terra to get to the same size as a relation of the total crypto market. And then it also went to zero roughly around the same time of the peak, right? Like as the markets were fleeing, as like the game was up, as like the dance of chicken was like, all right, who's going to sell? Who's going to sell? And then roughly halfway through 2018, BitConnect crashed, and roughly halfway through 2022, Terra crashed. I mean, those are the patterns I'm seeing.
No, the patterns are definitely very similar. I think the main difference, as you mentioned, is like the scale of it. Like obviously Terra was much bigger, but I think it wasn't just like the Luna token. Terra was like a double whammy, right? Because like there was the Luna token, but there was also the stable coin that was attached to it, right? And then on top of that, there were all the people going through these kind of like neobanks, which are like front ends for Terra, that had no idea what they were doing. They just saw this APY number like, oh, I can earn 20% on my dollars. I'm going to put it in here, right? And then they didn't read the fine print, because if you read the fine print, it says you can lose all your money potentially, because that's just, you know, classic legal speak. No one ever expects that to actually happen, but it happened this time. And I think that that's what caught a lot of people. And obviously a lot of people have lost a shit ton of money. I mean, not just individuals, not just kind of like everyday people, but massive funds and kind of like prop trading firms and market makers. Like I think that like most people in crypto were hurt by this in one way or another. Everyone was hurt by it indirectly, because the prices went down because of this, I think. It was just such a shock to the system, I think. But the thing is that just kind of looking for positives in this, I think ETH fared quite well, like in it all. I don't know, so far at least. I think that the Ethereum has gotten a lot of tailwinds from this. I think I think that, you know, the people that have kind of like been hurt, maybe they're not going to come back to crypto for a while. Especially the ones who were just like in it for the yield. They weren't even maybe holding Luna. They just had like the UST, and that's sad. It's kind of like set adoption back a kind of quite a while there, but it really does validate like the Ethereum thesis, I think, of building, you know, decentralized, secure and sustainable kind of infrastructure rather than just doing it in a cowboy fashion. And I remember, I don't know if I've said it on Bankers before, but I've said it on my own show plenty of times where I say to people, you have to reframe the decentralization argument as security. So instead of asking, yes, do you care about decentralization, you ask, do you care about security? And now you ask any Terra people about this question now, they're going to say yes, right? But if you ask them if they cared about decentralization before, they may have just given you a non-answer or not really paid attention to it. But, you know, no one cares about it until they need it. And then when they need it, they really, really need it, right? So I think that's the main takeaway for me from all of this, that's for sure.
And this has been the drum that has been beat by like a number of like core crypto people for a very long time. Like this was a conversation back in 2017, 2018, when it was EOS and the zero transaction fees of EOS versus like the blockchain fee model of Ethereum, right? Like we've seen this rodeo before. I was actually talking to, there's also like this whole prioritization of scale over security, both works at the layer one layer and also the app layer two. Right. And so I was talking to our guy, our analyst at Bankless, Ben, and talking about the patterns here. And I said, like, DAI supply always lags DAI demand, which is like if there is demand of DAI, it'll prop up the value of the stablecoin and then people will mint more DAI, but with real collateral. And so like DAI only scales out its supply of DAI if there is actual real bona fide demand of DAI. And like in the same thing with like Ethereum, this block space demand for Ethereum lags behind demand, right? So when transaction fees are high, it creates the need for layer twos, it creates the need for scale, but it doesn't answer scale first, right? And neither does DAI. DAI doesn't mint excess DAI and then give it to the market. Ethereum doesn't mint excess block space and give it to the market. These things lag demand because they prioritize security. But then on the flip side of things, the Terra UST supply, they just minted that thing like fucking mint UST, buy Bitcoin, like short, like, but without creating any amount of demand. And this is what Solana is doing when it's minting infinite block space. It is just the money printer block space, and it causes the chain to go down over time. And so these like bull market chains, which is like my new word for monolithic blockchains, these bull market chains are just minting out supply, selling their product for a discount, devaluing their product because that's the competitive advantage. They're like the off-brand blockchain. So they're devaluing their product and just like injecting it into the market, say, cheap, 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 buy it. But then when the bear market comes, like they have no real sustainability and they have like infinite supply. And so like it exists in the app layer, it exists at the core protocol level. And like in hindsight, it just makes total sense that things that devalue their product to go out to the market can't sustain themselves in a bear market.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think that's why like our points fall on deaf ears a lot of the time during the bull markets, is because this is stuff that it's not immediately apparent to most people, especially new people. They've got no idea for the context around this. They haven't been around, they haven't experienced a bear market or anything like that. To them, it's kind of like all the coins are going up, you know, and if you say anything against that, you're just a dirty fudder, dirty ETH maxi, we don't want to listen to you sort of thing, right? And that's exactly what happened with, I mean, you guys, you and Ryan, were some of the champions of calling out Terra, right? Like the show that you did just a few weeks ago, and everything like that. And you guys were called out relentlessly for it, especially by Doe himself, right?
Like my emotions, I felt that.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, this is one of the reasons why I try not to get too involved with it as well, is because I don't want to have to deal with like all that crap, even though I know that, I'm right. I don't want to have to kind of like deal with the crap that gets swung at me. And yeah, just seeing you guys go through that, I was like, holy shit, this is insane. And I think that's what a lot of people miss, is that we're not like, now that everything collapsed, we're not dancing on the graves of people who lost money. We're dancing on the graves of Dokkan and his lunatic army, who literally didn't listen to anyone, you know, kept insulting everyone who ever brought up anything wrong with the system and acted like kings and gods, and nothing could, you know, I think nothing bad could happen to them. And that's it. Like, yes, it may be a little bit too much, but I think I think social signaling is very, very important here, because that's the only accountability and recourse we really have in crypto, is social signaling. Because there's no, I mean, the government might go after Dokkan himself, but there's no government to bail out anything here. Like, they let everyone let Luna go to zero and UST basically go to zero because there's no bailout. Like, who's going to bail them out? The only bailout comes from the private enterprise. And eventually the private enterprise was like, no, man, this is too toxic. We're not going to touch this, right? Doesn't matter if it was, quote unquote, too big to fail or something. There's none of that in crypto. Things will fail, and they'll fail very, very quickly. And I think to prevent this sort of stuff happening in the future, you really have to social signal. You really have to get everyone on board with this. So next time there's a algo stablecoin that comes out, you have everyone calling it out, right? Like, there was people calling Terra out, but it wasn't the majority. And a lot of people were scared to call it out because they had this massive army that would swarm you as soon as you did. So we need to break past that. Like, if we let that dominate the industry, then this stuff's just going to keep playing out again and again. And as a lot of people have already mentioned, it's going to bring with it a lot of bad regulation, right? It's going to set crypto adoption back years. So, I mean, again, kudos to you guys for calling it out for so long and kind of like putting up with all that crap, because that's not something that I really, really can do. Like, I really hate, I try to avoid conflict most of the time with these, especially with these armies, man. They just come from nowhere. I don't think a lot of them are real people. They have to be bots, right? Like, it's just insane.
Some supply, yeah. And the bots have to like find real people to convince themselves to like mix themselves in with the real people, so the bots can be like, or the bots, not the necessarily the bots, but just like the Sybil attackers, right? Just like one guy with like 10, 15, 100 accounts or something like that, which you would consider bots. Well, I think there's two things I want to say to that. Like, there were a lot of like VCs that were very much a part of this whole thing. And like, at some point, there's like so many people ended up supporting this ecosystem that you just have to say that they were duped. Like, it's like some people just like took the Kool-Aid. So like, algo stablecoins, they work this time. Like, it's this time it's different. Like, we're that fund's in it and this fund's in it, so like, I'll be in it too. Like, we're all promoting its legitimacy, even though like at the base layer, like, there's like a bunch of like hot air here. I did a podcast with a VC who talked, and I asked about like, okay, what are the fundamentals of VCs like as a concept? It's like, why are there VCs? And one of his answers was that like, well, VCs provide legitimacy, right? And so like, when you onboard with a VC, when you take money from a VC rather than a bunch of angels, that VC has network connections, that VC can do things for you. Like, the best VCs create the best premium because they have the best returns. And so the competition is based on what VCs can provide the most value to, blah, 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 blah. And so like, if we're talking about like the fallout collateral damage of these things, like, the market needs to reassess the value of various VCs in this industry, because some VCs were on one side of this trade in this industry and the other VCs were not, right? Like, Fred Arisim from Paradigm tweeted out the guy from the 2008 crisis movie, The Big Short, who's like I can't remember his name, the guy that also was in the GameStop.
But Michael Burry, I think Michael Burry, name is, yeah, played, right? Played by Christian Bale in that movie.
Exactly, yeah. Who knows if they like were actually short or are they just tweeting out a meme? I don't know, but it kind of implies that they were taking the other side of this trade, as in shorting Luna. And there were some VCs that were very much in promotion of it to the point of shilling it, right? Like, as some of these VCs do. And so like, we need to like reassess which VCs were on like the right side of history, and especially Tarun Chitra, which is actually where I was going with this next. He was on Laura Shin's like All In styled podcast, and he talked about how people that make algo stablecoins just inherently must have this god complex, and they don't look at history, and they just ignore history, and they're like, I've just created alchemy, like, I am the stablecoin god, I can mint coins out of thin air, like, look at this magic, I'm like a billionaire, I will bet on like the future price of my token in a $20 million bet that I make on Twitter because I'm a fucking Chad, and if anyone denies me and if anyone doubts me, like, I'll just like throw my stablecoins at you. And like, this is Dokkan, man. And like, algo stablecoins, and I'm learning about this too in like the last week. So it's not like I knew this ahead of time, but like, the whole algo stablecoin thing is the same thing as like the Zimbabwe dollar. It's the same thing as Weimar Germany. It's just a straight up hyperinflation event sped up in real time. And Dokkan should have known this because he did basis cash on the app layer. But then because it was on the app layer, it failed. And so he had to go make a separate L1 so it couldn't be economically attacked by flash loans or all that other shit or whatever. And then he just starts playing God, right? And so like, there's so much like hubris and status and legitimacy that's involved in these things that are inherently faith-based at the end of the day. Anyways, end rant.
No, I mean, I think... I think from all of that, the main takeaway for people should be that just because someone is a VC or is a fund or works at a fund or whatever and has money doesn't make them more intelligent than you, right? There's not much correlation between money and intelligence. That's one thing I've learned definitely being in crypto the last few years. There are billionaires who are really dumb. And that might seem counterintuitive. You might think, just how can a billionaire be dumb? Well, put it this way, guys. Crypto has created so much wealth in such a short period of time. There are people that could have become billionaires by literally just throwing, maybe six figures into ETH at the ICO, for example, right?
There's also a difference between intelligence and ability to make money at the same time.
Yeah. Exactly. So I think... that should be one of the main takeaways from this. And also these things can go on longer than you think they can. I mean, I think the reason why that picture was shared of Michael Burry on Twitter, or one of the reasons, I don't know if that was short or not, was that in the movie, it shows how Michael Burry was betting against the housing market really early on, and the housing market kept going crazy, right? And he was betting against it for such a long time, and everyone was calling him out. They were saying, man, it's still growing. What are you talking about? This is crazy. This is a crazy trade. You're pissing away our money. And then the same thing happened here, where people were calling this out for a very long time, and then it kept growing and growing and growing. And everyone was like, oh, okay, well, it's gotten to such a big size now, it's too big to fail, right? It's not going to fail. It's all well and good. And then people were waiting. They were like, no, it's going to fail. We're going to get our dues eventually. It's basically mathematically programmed to fail, which it was. And it did. It failed exactly how the bears said it would. It didn't even deviate from that because it was programmed. All you needed to do was read the white paper to see exactly how this worked. And it did that. And the funny thing is, though, is that the Terraform Labs, the main team behind Terra, could have wound this down a lot a lot more gracefully than what happened, right? They did nothing. They actually let it go to zero. They could have paused the chain. They could have paused minting. They could have done all this other stuff, right?
And they didn't have any contingency plan. They had no idea this could happen.
That's what I'm saying. So that's kind of we were talking about with Do Kwon and kind of him feeling like a god and him feeling like nothing could go wrong. And he was had all this alchemy. He could just print money out of thin air. They had no plan for when everything went to shit inevitably. And because of that, everything went to shit. It actually went to zero. CoinGecko did minus 100% on Luna because it rounded it to the nearest zero, which was zero. I was like, what the hell? This is crazy. I think that it's right. And the thing is that you talk about kind of people not learning from history. The algo stablecoins within the crypto context actually went back really far. I think as far back as 2014 or even earlier than that, right?
Yeah, before Ethereum was a thing.
Yeah, exactly. So this is definitely not new. But the thing is that these things are very easy to grow in a bull market when everyone's throwing money at you. They're very reflexive on the upside as well as to the downside. And you can easily kind of pump your token like this, right? And make it work for a little bit. So I think because of those facts, this isn't going to be the last of them that we see. They're going to take other forms. People are going to be like, oh, it's not like the other algo stablecoins. This one's actually going to work, right? And we're just going to see this play out again. But that's why I said the social signaling is so powerful, because you keep signaling that these things, they can't work. They're just kind of fundamentally broken. More people will believe you when you say that, because it's not just crying wolf anymore. The wolf came to fucking eat the chickens, right? And it ate a lot of chickens.
Right. I don't know. There's the optimistic, cautiously optimistic take that when the $50 billion algo stablecoin ecosystem goes to zero, then we learn our lesson. We won't learn it at $10 billion. We won't learn it at $20 billion. But okay, at $50 billion, we'll learn the lesson. How do you feel about that?
Have we learned the lesson? Because there's going to be new people coming in who haven't learned this lesson at all next cycle, right?
I did say that, the last bull market, we did have a top 10 coin do the same thing. It was an actual Ponzi.
Yeah.
That is one of the differences about this whole Ponzi collapse, is that this one was pumped by a lot of just ecosystem people. I mean, as you and I pump ETH, but at least ETH doesn't blow up, though. We pump the thing that stays around.
But I mean, also ETH can't just go to zero like that at all. Right. I mean, ETH has fallen a lot in the past, but it can't do that unless it was I don't even know the scenario where ETH would go to zero unless there was an infinite mint bug, but then it would just get reversed and whatever.
And that's what you were saying exactly. About the Terra ecosystem could have mitigated this. And if even in worst case Ethereum scenarios, we can still mitigate that.
Yeah, exactly. And the funny thing is that you're right. They would have had no plan at all. Like, they should have had a worst case scenario plan. It's like, hey guys, like, what happens when it goes into a death spiral? But I truly believe that Do Kwon and probably his closest kind of like people within the company didn't believe that it could death spiral. They actually believed that they had created something that was basically a perpetual motion machine, an infinite money printer. Mm-hmm. And that obviously wasn't the case. And I think his ego is infinite. Like, I actually don't think he's learned his lesson. I've been seeing his tweets. He's not remorseful. It seems like he just wants to try and get it back up and running and kind of like, you know, restore his god status. Yeah, and do it again, right? But it's not going to happen. It's the same with every other one that we've seen. Like Daniel Sesta, right? You guys called that out as well. The Frog Nation crap. Like, same thing happened there. A bunch of others. Andre Cronje is a bit of a different scenario, but he eventually got to that status. Like, you know, but he is a bit of a different scenario. Yeah, it was definitely adjacent. But there's so many of these things, right? And I think that people just need to stop creating cults. Like, let's stop creating cults of personality around these people, guys. Like, it's not healthy. It doesn't lead us anywhere good. But yeah, man, like, I don't know, craziest kind of like week in crypto for me, just because of the speed and you know, just the mental kind of like mind fuck of it all was just insane. And I think the legitimacy thing is the last thing I wanted to talk about. You're right in that, like, I think what ended up happening was that because it kept growing and because it didn't fail like its detractors said it would for such a long period of time, at least in crypto, you know, a year is like an eternity, right? And then all these kind of like VCs and funds and legitimate people piled on, because I think it was partly due that they didn't want to miss the train, but they also didn't want to get kind of like attacked, right, for going against the grain, because they're like, oh, you know, I can't, as we're discussing, it's really hard to put up with this sort of stuff. Like, it's actually, it makes you feel really bad. You feel it when you're getting attacked by this mob. So I think a lot of them either defaulted to just being neutral and not really saying anything about it, or going in on it and being like, I can join this train too. I can make money. I can, you know, have everyone loving me because of it. And the people that did that, they're like massive, kind of like taking massive reputational hits here. And I don't know, like, I think they're going to be the most affected by it in the long term, because the people in this industry know those people and they remember things. They keep the receipts, right? And they definitely don't let this slide. But on the retail side of things, yeah, I mean, I don't expect the retail investors to learn too much about this sort of stuff.
Yeah, you did mention about how this was going to set us back and like hinted at regulation. So I want to talk about that next. But before you do, guys, every now and then I pull my friend Anthony here into a live stream every Friday, sometimes Thursday. It used to be consistent, but that was during COVID. And since non-COVID, it's been a little bit harder. But every now and then we do this. I'd say about once a month, maybe once every 6 weeks. I don't know if you guys are living under a rock, but if you are living under a rock, you can follow Anthony at his Daily Gray YouTube channel, which I just posted in the chat there. He does these YouTube videos. Yes, a ridiculous amount of days, almost every single day, except for
every
Sunday?
Single weekday.
Every single weekday.
Yeah, not Saturday and Sunday. Yeah, just weekdays.
I ask you that every single time because I always forget. But like, there's one of the few podcasts that I listen to every single day. And his YouTube channel is right there. He also does a Daily Grid newsletter, which he puts out also every fucking day. So he's one of these guys that produces a lot of content like Bankless, which you can also go ahead and subscribe to. Okay. I've gotten better at this, by the way.
the shilling is done.
Okay. So how far is this going to set back our industry and regulation? I think those are perhaps the topics next. People, I've heard this line that like, okay, it set back the crypto industry like 1 to 2 years. And I think my gut take was like, ooh, wow, really? That seems like a long amount of time. And so first question there. Also, I'm kind of down for that. Like, I'm kind of down for a slow bear market. Like, how do you feel about these things?
Look, the timeline on it is basically impossible to say. Like, anyone giving timelines on this sort of stuff is just guessing, pure guessing. There is no rhyme or reason to any timelines you could give, right? Because, for example, we could go to all-time highs again and the adoption would pick up like exponentially again, right? Because I think the main thing that drives adoption in crypto is prices going up. Like, we have enough evidence to support that. So I don't think you can actually put a timeline on how long this is kind of like, quote unquote, set adoption back or anything like that. What I think is true here is that it has set adoption back in the sense that it's going to suppress the prices for a while. It's going to put us into this deep bear market, and it's going to bring with it more regulation and increased scrutiny, which is going to make teams probably ship slower because of the fact that they're going to be more scared to ship certain things due to regulations, due to kind of like law enforcement and things like that. And we're probably going to get less innovation out of that too, because everyone's going to be scared of, does this look like a Ponzi, or does this look like, you know, Terra? Can I get in trouble for this? And this is probably most true for the Docs teams. Maybe the Anon teams keep kind of doing what they're doing. And I think that people are going to be cautious about jumping into these things for a while as well, because they might be like, you know, is this going to blow up like Terra again? Like, I don't want to put money into this. I don't want to lose my money. I don't want what happened to Terra folks to happen to me. So those are kind of like the effects that I see happening. But timelines, it's impossible, man. Like, I don't think anyone can give a timeline on this sort of stuff.
Yeah. But how do you feel about that being a good thing or a neutral thing or bad thing? Like, I think the gut take is like, it's a bad thing because we want crypto to take over the world. But taking the perspective of like a first cycler, especially perhaps a first cycler that just got hurt, right? Like, maybe they were in Bitcoin and ETH and they only have seen a 65% drawdown instead of being in Terra or being a 100% drawdown, or in an alt layer one and being at 85%. Like, for the first cycler out there who's like looking at crypto prices being like, F, I'm pro good thing for that part of the population.
Yeah, I mean most first cyclers are already gone, I think. Like, really? they leave, right? I mean, in terms of kind of like, if they're here for like a first cycle and they just kind of like speculate and they lose money and they leave, right? But if we're talking about like first cyclists who actually stick around and wait for the next cycle to come around, right. I think they're like, from my experience talking to some of them, they're actually very excited, right? They're very excited because they're going to be able to buy things at a cheaper price. Of course, they're going to be able to scoop up some value kind of like out there, right? And they also, I think, have the same belief that I have in that this industry isn't ready for mainstream adoption, dude. Like, nowhere close, right? I'm sorry, but like, there are so many issues with what we're building still. The scale issues is a major one. UI, UX. Like, I'm sorry, but like, how are we ready for mass adoption? I mean, you know, Polinar actually goes on about this a lot, and he's they're pretty steadfast about this, but they say they're still very disappointed in this industry because we've built so many Ponzi's and so many money games and things like that, but we're not actually building anything that's mass adoptable because we're still waiting for scale, right? And that's here and coming and improving over time. We're still building out the core infrastructure, still upgrading things, blah, 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 still getting Ethereum through the merge and things like that. But like, even on the UI UX side of things, like, it's still very hard. And the funny thing is that where we were making progress on this with the neobanks, a lot of them just went to Anchor because that was the top yield, and they've wrecked their users, right? So like, it was getting better, and now we've kind of like been set back by that a little bit. And regulators are definitely coming for those neobanks. They're fucked. Like, honestly, like, this is anything that kind of like does that and sits as a front end on top of things, it doesn't actually make the risks like readily available to users, is fucked. Like, in my eyes.
Yeah. And they should be regulated, right? Like if they're a centralized entity. If you can be regulated, you should be regulated. If you can't be regulated, then you shouldn't be regulated. And this is a very fair take, because a ton of, like you said, layers around Anchor just like effed a lot of people who put in deposits thinking, wow, like 20% savings account, amazing, take all my money. And like, you know, like, some people are a lot of people are going to get sucked in by that. Where was I going to go with this? Going back to like the whole first cycle or like prices thing, like the ones that stick around, there's this very savage quote out of the Bitcoiner camp that I like, what's the word? Schadenfreudenly love, which is people buy Bitcoin at the price they deserve it, which you can extrapolate that to Ether, right? But like, it's basically a timing in the market, as in just like, people who got in early deserved it because they saw the vision early. But also, if we're going down into a bear market and people are like, you know, losing their wealth because it's their first cycle and they're getting hurt, but they stick around, like, they're going to buy Ether, Bitcoin, their preferred asset, at the price that they deserve it, right? And so it's great to hear that like, people are coming into this bear market like excited, especially when there's like, so, like, I think we're in the golden age of building right now. The layer two summer, which is not at the sound of things going to be like a price summer, but it's going to be a building summer, is perfect. If we have the golden age of building on layer twos, which is literally surface area for further, like surface area for high growth DeFi apps with tokens and user acquisition onboarding capacities because of low fees. If that golden age of building happens during a bear market, it means the people that stick around and believe just have this opportunity. For, I don't know, how many years are people saying this Terra thing is going to set us back? 1 to 2 years. And so we're going to have like the golden age of Ethereum building because people can't fucking like differentiate Ethereum from the rest of DeFi. And so like the people who have that information asymmetry about the secure, sustainable layer two app layer building, which also has bridges in between those things. So there's surface area there to build stuff as well. Like there's going to be so much opportunity while people just forget about the crypto industry once again, as they do every 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the reason why at least the first cyclists that I talk to are so excited is because like I've given like my personal story many times in my community on my show about how like I stuck around, I doubled down during the bear market, and like not just myself, but like so many of the people that you see that are really successful today did the same thing. And I give like the reasons why it's like really good to do that and why kind of like it can work out for you. It's not guaranteed to, but like it can work out for you and why you should stick around. And I think that's why they're just so excited, right? Like some of them obviously are going to be underwater on their ETH buys already because maybe they got in later and they bought it like 3-4K. Yeah, exactly. And I explain that to them. I'm like, and I put a percentage number on it because I say to them like, hey, you know, if you bought it 4K right now, sorry, 4K back a few months ago, and the price is 2K now, you're down 50%, of course, right? And I say to them, I did the same thing in October 2018, where I bought ETH at $220, thinking it was the bottom, and then ETH went to $80. So I was down more than 50%. And the thing is, people don't realize the intuitiveness of kind of like the numbers and the percentages. Like, just because the numbers were much smaller doesn't mean the percentages were different. Like, right. It's the same thing. it's the same amount of money lost. So kind of like from that perspective, I think that's what my my viewers and my listeners, people kind of like who are in my community, are really paying attention to that sort of stuff. So that's why they're excited about it. But I think there's not many of those people. Like the majority do not stick around for the bear market. They leave and they come back and they regret it. They're like, oh my God, why did I leave? Right. So I think there's a lot of that going on, definitely. And I think that's exciting for those people. I hope they do stick around. Like they get jobs too. Like a lot of them are getting jobs within crypto, which is something that a lot of us couldn't do back in the day because there wasn't that many jobs to go around. But now there's heaps, right? Yeah, so you know, I think it's exciting. Oh, my camera's gone out of focus. Oh, we're back. Yeah.
The differences between these bear markets, I think, are very, very stark. So much more surface area to build stuff. Like going back to the 2017-2018 bear market, as when I started this, when I decided that like I'm going to be in this crypto thing, like I can't remember why I was bullish about Ethereum. Like there was nothing in 2018 that was like worthwhile to stick around for. Like DeFi wasn't a thing. NFTs weren't a thing. And like, why the hell did I stick around? I don't really know. But that lends itself to like those people buy crypto at the price of their choice. People buy Ether at the price that they deserve it, right? Like they're the people that stuck around, saw the potential. And so like Ether is a little bit higher now, but like the amount of surface area and jobs and just cash that is in this ecosystem right now, because there've been a ton of money being raised. So like there's going to be a lot more jobs and a lot more room for jobs for people to come into this market and stick around and then actually just buy the dip for 2 years straight. Hopefully not that long.
Yeah. No, I think in 2018, there was a spark, basically, like a small little kind of like spark that we all kind of potentially saw. But like, there's something here. We don't know exactly what it is, but there's definitely something here. And I think in 2022, there's a raging wildfire. There's no spark. It's kind of like, we know what's here. We know what we're going to build. We know what works. We know everything that's coming. Well, not everything, but we know like, you know, what we're building, what we're doing. And I think that's the like a key difference. But yeah, also the fact that it's just much easier to get a job now. So more people are going to stick around for that. Like 2018 was basically impossible to get a job in crypto.
It was
like,
so it was, hard, dude. I was lucky enough to get 3 jobs in crypto and 2 of them blew up after like 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, there was getting a job and then there was getting a sustainable job, right? Mm-hmm. One that wasn't going to run out of money or blow up or anything like that. I mean, I got my job in mid-2019 with kind of like Set. And they hadn't raised, I think, since their first raise or whatever. And they kind of like needed to raise, but the market was like super quiet. And then, you know, all that, the rest is history from there. But yeah, joining a crypto startup back then was much riskier than it is today. Like today they have so much money. Like it's right. just stupid amounts of money, right?
And real products and real customers. Like these are the differences yeah. here.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So I think you know, the first cyclists this time around are going to have a way easier time than we had, but that's good. I like that. Yes. I don't
this is
adoption. Want to yeah, I don't want to experience 2018, 2019 again. Like it wasn't a fun time, that's for
right.
sure.
Right. Okay, changing subjects here, unless you have anything else you want to touch on. Did you watch the Hal Press super bullish Ether video that we did on Bankless?
I'm like halfway through it. Yeah. I've heard really good things about that from my community as well. They've watched it too. But yeah, I mean, if you want to TLDR it for people, I guess. Yeah,
I think the quickest thing I'll TLDR is that he just makes the illustration that Ethereum is at this particular equilibrium right now because of miner sell pressure, like all proof of work blockchains are. And because like every single day, the equilibrium of the ETH price has been like set towards a particular amount of $1 million of sell pressure every single day to secure the blockchain. And as soon as we go and do the merge, it flips on its head where it goes, I can't remember the numbers. I think it was something like $15 million a day, which is like not small. $15 million a day of sell pressure every single day is like, you know, you got to tally some numbers up over the time. And then when the merge happens, it flips. So it goes from $15 million of sell pressure to $15 million of buy pressure. And so over the last, how many years of Ethereum? 7 years of Ethereum's lifespan. Like it's just come to this equilibrium of just figuring out how to live inside of a market that has $15 million a day of sell pressure. And then all of a sudden it flips and goes to buy pressure, just like the snap of the fingers, right? And so and so one of my questions for him was like, okay, how long will that flip turn to like manifest in the actual price of the thing? Like his answer was basically like pretty fucking fast. And so this guy has calls out for $8,000 Ether in December, bro. This December.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not his only position, but that's like his most bullish position. But like nuts, dude.
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously super bullish on ETH, but 8,000 by December seems, I mean, it's a good bet, like if it happens, because like he's probably going to make a lot of money on that if it does materialize. But yeah, I mean, the speed at which things happen is kind of hard to tell as well, I think, in this industry, because it's like slowly then all at once is kind of like the motto, right, for a lot of these things. But I think the main takeaway I've had, as I said, I've only listened to half of it, but the main takeaway I got from what he was talking about was that he looks at these things as like just businesses, right, like cash flow, businesses with expenses, all that sort of stuff. And he kind of like articulates the point quite well in that these other blockchains, even if they're proof of stake, they're leaking so much value because they're paying validators to inflation, but not offsetting that with a fee burn that can actually offset that. Yes, they may have a fee burn implemented, but they're not burning enough to kind of like be sustainable, right? Whereas Ethereum is net deflationary literally every single block once the merge goes through, and we've been net deflationary on proof of work days, which is just like insane, right? And yeah, that minor sell pressure gone. There's no withdrawals directly after the merge for like at least 6 months,
which is
right?
a gimmick, but like for 6 months it matters.
I mean, I think it's a narrative, right? It's a narrative that'll push the price higher in my mind. But definitely, I think that he articulated all that quite well. And I mean, him betting his whole fund on ETH, right? That's what he's doing. Yeah, he's betting his entire fund on ETH.
ETH, like, and he's ETH my type of person. Like, and he watches the Alcor devs call, bro. He actually, which is actually crazy to think about, as in like the Ethereum ecosystem builds in the open. Right? Like it builds transparently, it builds inside out. And so there's like this one guy who has like, $30, $50 million fund. I don't know the numbers. But he was like, yeah, no one else is doing this. But I'm going to listen to the Alcor devs call and just like expose myself more and more and more to as the merge comes. And so like, we asked him, it's like, is anyone else doing this? He goes like, no one else is doing this. I don't know why. Right, it's like some people tune into the investor calls. Some people tune into the Federal Reserve notes, and other people tune into like how much progress the Ethereum client teams have made on the merge. And that's this guy, and like he's aping the entire fund into the merge. And his prediction is that like, and this is a guy who's like he's got skin in the game, right? And so like It's not you and me who are like, you're pretty balanced about this. Sometimes I get a little bit over my ski tips and I'm like, guys, merge coming soon. But I'm inside of the Ethereum ecosystem and he is outside of the Ethereum ecosystem with the fund on the line, like neutral, unbiased third party. And he's like, August. I think it's August. Yeah.
Which is nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, that matches exactly with my expectations that I've had for a while now, which is cool to just see that kind of like validated there. But I think, yeah, there's kind of like listening to the call itself and then reading like the headlines. Like, for example, yesterday I put out a tweet announcing that Robston was going to be kind of like run through the testnet merge, sorry, the merge on June 8th or approximately June 8th, right? That's the headline. That's like a tiny bit of that, you know, whole core devs call. And you can get so much alpha by just listening to the call itself, right? And kind of like getting all the nitty gritty details, not just around the merge, but around kind of like everything else. And I think that's, you know, what he's trying to do, which is awesome. Like, you know what? The funny thing is I don't even listen to the calls because a lot of the time they happen when I'm sleeping, but I do read the notes and keep on top of it. But yeah, there's even more alpha to be had by just sitting there listening to the calls and like embracing kind of like the whole Ethereum thing. So yeah, I mean, I think he's gonna have a very good time over the coming years with that bet. Definitely. I mean, obviously, I'm biased, but I think he's making an amazing bet there, and I'm glad to see that because it sends a signal to the kind of the ecosystem, to other money managers that hey, you know, you don't have to bet your whole fund here, but there is something here, definitely. And he articulates it in such a way that maybe you and I don't from like a traditional finance perspective, which is what we need because it's all well and good for me to give the bull thesis for ETH, but I give it as an Ethereum. I give the kind of like in the weeds stuff.
The crypto native
I don't pitch. Articulate yeah. it. Exactly. I don't give the analogies that he was giving. So I think that is extremely important because most people are not crypto natives. Most of the money in the world is 99% of it is not in crypto, right? So to get it into crypto, we need people to articulate it in such a way that normies can understand, right? And people, normies in the crypto context can understand. And I think that's exactly what he's doing. So yeah, I mean, I'm keen to finish the rest of it, but a lot of alpha in that, you know, that show just in of itself.
Yeah, it was definitely our first episode with him, and it was our first time like engaging with this guy. So like the episode, it was like a very long episode for what we did. It was like an hour, 1¾ hours. But we're definitely going to have him back on as we get better at talking to this guy and communicating with him and seeing how he perceives things. Because there's value in the crypto native pitch because, I mean, I'm all for tearing down old standards of doing things and like replacing TradFi with BetterFi. But also at the same time, the fact that we can retrofit Ether fundamentals onto tried and true fundamentals of the old world. And it's not like they just like, it's not like their thing is just made up. Like those are real metrics with real analysis and real fundamentals that the majority of wealth in this world understands. And the fact that we can retrofit Ether into those models and it comes out with an output that makes a ton of sense and not only makes a ton of sense, but it's really effing bullish, then all of a sudden, like the old money can couple to the new money via this common understanding, right? Like one of my favorite lines is that the most bullish thing for Ether is to be understood, right? And we can take Ether metrics and plug them into old algorithms to spit out a very bullish answer that is interpretable by trillions of dollars. Right, like that's as collapsed as I can get the whole thesis.
Yeah, and I think on that understood notion, so the bet on Ether, I think, or the bet on like just assets in general, like investing in general, is that there is information asymmetry. There is kind of like an understanding or an information arbitrage to be had here where you have access to this information before the majority of people. And, you know, you are making the bet that information is going to continue being dispersed. It's going to continue kind of like flowing into the rest of the world, the rest of the money. And that money is going to eventually understand and kind of like come into ETH. And that's how obviously the price appreciates over time, over the long term, at least. So that's kind of like the bet. And I think that it's a really good bet because over time, ETH and Ethereum have become more understood, right? It went from basically not being understood at all in you know, 2018, 2019 to being the, you know, people, you know, even like the most kind of like ardent, like not anti-ETH people, but the people that wouldn't really support Ethereum or ETH are now collapsing in and themselves saying, I was wrong. ETH actually has kind of like value, all this sort of stuff, right? So I think that's the most bullish thing, I think, for me. But yeah, I mean, we could talk about being bullish on ETH all day, of course.
Oh, and I think we shall, right?
Are we got a surprise guest?
Yeah, he's not coming in yet. I kind of jumped the gun on that, but he should be here in a couple moments.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll leave the guests hanging with who's coming in here, but he can only stay for a few minutes, but not, so can we. MakerDAO is the OG DeFi protocol. The MakerDAO produces DAI, the industry's most battle-tested and resilient stablecoin. Using Maker, you don't need to sell your collateral if you need liquidity. Instead, you can spin up a Maker vault and use your collateral to mint DAI directly. With Maker, the power to mint new money is in your hands. The Maker protocol is extremely hardened and operated by one of the most experienced DAOs in existence. They've been here since the beginning, they've seen it all, and so you can mint DAI with the assurance that your collateral is safe. Soon, Maker will be present on all chains and L2s, so minting DAI can take place on Oasis.app, Zerion, Zapper, or any other DeFi protocol that you use. Follow Maker on Twitter, at MakerDAO, and learn from the oldest and most resilient DAO in existence. Arbitrum is an Ethereum Layer 2 scaling solution that's going to completely change how we use DeFi and NFTs. Over 300 projects have already deployed to Arbitrum, and the DeFi and NFT ecosystems are growing rapidly. Some of the coolest and newest NFT collections have chosen Arbitrum as their home, all the while DeFi protocols continue to see increased usage and liquidity. Using Arbitrum has never been easier, especially with the ability to deposit directly into Arbitrum through all the exchanges, including Binance, FTX, Huobi, and Crypto.com. Once inside, you'll notice Arbitrum increases Ethereum speed by orders of magnitude for a fraction of the cost of the average gas fee. If you're a developer who wants low gas fees and instant transactions for your users, visit arbitrum.io/developer to start building your dApp on Arbitrum. If you're a degen, many of your favorite dApps on Ethereum are already on Arbitrum, with many moving over every day. Go to bridge.arbitrum.io now to start bridging over your ETH and other tokens in order to experience DeFi NFTs in the way it was always meant to be. Fast, cheap, secure, and friction-free. The Brave browser is the user-first browser for the Web3 internet, with over 50 million monthly active users. Control your digital footprint with built-in privacy and ad blocking. Inside the Brave browser, you'll find the Brave wallet, the first secure crypto wallet built natively inside of a Web3 crypto browser. Web3 is freedom from big tech and Wall Street, more control and better privacy. But there's a weak point in Web3, your crypto wallet. The Brave wallet is different. Brave wallet is built natively inside the Brave browser, no extension required, which gives the Brave wallet an extra level of security versus other wallets. With the Brave wallet, you can buy, store, send, and swap your crypto assets, and you can even manage your NFTs and connect to other wallets and DeFi apps, all from the security of the best privacy browser on the market. Whether you're new to crypto or a seasoned pro, it's time to switch to the Brave wallet. Download Brave at brave.com/bankless and click the wallet icon to get started. What's up, guys? Anthony and I do this every now and then. If you're new to Bankless, which is crazy, you should definitely subscribe, but you should also subscribe to the link that I put in the top chat, which is Anthony's Daily Way YouTube channel, which he puts out daily videos about the Ethereum ecosystem and keeps us up to speed and also critiques the things that should be critiqued every now and then. And so, you should subscribe to his channel there. Let's see, where do we want to go from here?
What's on my mind actually right now, outside of all the craziness of the last week, is just how close the merge is. I know we were just talking about, but like, come on, man, like it's May and we're expecting it in August. Like it's so close.
That's
like it's
3 months.
Like,
that's 3 months.
Exactly. Like I was just, cause like the Shadow forks are going well. They announced the testnet, as I mentioned before, the Robson testnet fork on the Core Devs call today. Like it's so goddamn close. Like I feel it. Like I can see it. Like it's there. I just want to grab it and kind of like, yeah. So I'm just like, I'm ecstatic. Like I can't believe that we're just like almost at the finish line after so, so long. And I don't think people realize how close it is. There are still people who think that it's not going to happen at all. Like, what? Like, how does that even make any sense?
Did you see Corey Clips, you know, Swan Bitcoin? It's like this Bitcoin neobank, savings only neobank. Corey Clipson, the CEO, who I interviewed on POV Crypto way back in the day, he was a nice guy because he had to put on the nice I'm a CEO face. He tweeted out something, here's the secret that ETH maxis don't want you to know. Ethereum is just a more convoluted, like ridiculous version of Terra. And like I read that tweet and it would have been one thing if it was like 10, 15, 20 likes, but it had like 2,500 likes. And I was looking at this tweet and I'm like, what do I do with this? Like, how do I even begin here? Because you can't fight that fight on Twitter. 2,500 people liking a tweet that says Ethereum is just as convoluted, is more convoluted than Terra. Like, what are you going to do? You're going to fight that fight on Twitter? Are you serious? Mm-hmm. But like, the information asymmetry is only getting worse. Here's Eric. I mean, Doquan. Here's Doquan.
Doquan. It's Doquan.
What's up, man?
Yo, what's up, guys?
How's it? How
Oh
you
man,
doing?
I think you're all
Good,
your other
guys.
mics not on. I don't think your good mic's
Yeah,
on.
yeah, you're
Here we go.
There
Better.
we go.
Yeah, there
Much
we go.
better.
That's
Much
much better.
better. Eric Conner's in the house, man. Dude,
So we're doing an
you could
EPL
have
podcast now
died
with
for all
David
I
as a
know.
guest.
Yeah, if you guys remember, Anthony and I used to do a podcast together like 4 years ago. There might
We
be
have
some
we haven't
listeners
done
out
one in
there.
like 4 weeks now. Oh God, we've got to do it next week, man. Like we've let it go on too long.
Yeah, I think we have some angry listeners out there.
Well, maybe you guys can just do it here, huh?
Yeah. So
Right,
yeah.
you can be
What's
the
up, guys?
host.
You know, Eric, you know what I'm loving? I'm loving the most lately. The like your return to Twitter has just been, "Hey guys, I'm back. ETH gone to 10K. Shit post, shit post, shit post, shit post." Like it's just constant shit posting. It's just such a great return, man. I bet you're
Yeah,
having fun, right?
yeah, I'm loving it. Yeah, I mean, you guys know I love a good bear market. I'm not going to shy away from that. So
They are
the
your
second
favorite
I,
times.
right, exactly. The second I saw some desperation on Twitter, I decided it was time to hop back, but it was a good
Dude,
hiatus.
you could just
But
like
yeah, no
smell the
one.
blood in the air and just like, I'm coming
Yeah.
back.
You had to. Yeah. I mean, we need some comedy out there during bear markets. So no one take my post too seriously these days. But you know, I do truly believe though that people are overreacting. Like I mean, yeah, I know we hit 1700 or whatever, but we're still at like 2K. Like 18 months ago, we were all crying and we were at like 80. So I don't know. I'm not fully buying into the bear market stuff, but I mean, I know some people bought a lot higher than we're at, but
No, it was over 2 years ago. It was like 2 year, 4 months or something. When was it last 2 years, two months? Yeah.
Well,
It was
the phase zero launched December of 2020.
2020. Yeah. It's like
So, and that's right when ETH
1600
started
bucks or
taking off.
something.
So,
Yeah,
yeah.
well, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, also, we hit 2000, we hit like 1700 last May, right? And so, like, it's been 1 year since we've hit these prices.
It was the 1 year anniversary when we cra like May 12th was like the first big crash to 1700, and then we did it again. It's like it's so poetic how that happens. Like literally on the 1 year anniversary. Like but yeah, no, I mean I'm with Eric on that. Like I know it's easier for us to say since we bought ETH like at a lot cheaper than what it is today, but I don't know. Like I feel like people are acting like the world is ending. Like I mean, guys, if ETH goes down 94% again from its all-time high, it's like $300. If that's not happening, like if that happens, I feel like I mean, I'd be panicking like pretty badly. I'd be like in a corner being like, "What happened? How did it all go wrong?" Sorry,
Eric, are
yeah,
you back
I
on
don't know.
Twitter because you bought? Is that what happened?
You know, I didn't do my typical like YOLO, this is the bottom buy. I was talking to Anthony a little bit yesterday. I bought a few NFT dips mainly because I just see NFTs as like leveraged ETH. So, and there were a couple desperation plays out there I saw going on. So, you know, I did deploy some capital, but I haven't yet. So that's the thing though. Like, I don't make my like blood in the streets, yellow ETH bottom buy slash calls, unless like it's really blood in the street. And to me, 2000 is not blood in the street. What Anthony was just talking about is blood in the street. Like if we're talking like 300, 400, 500, and people are like, you know, it's funny. People are just spoiled these days, right? Like 55% off the high is not that bad. It's just not.
Right, but does that mean we're going down more?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I don't think so. I think ETH is. You know, Bitcoin only went down, what was it, like 80% when ETH went down 94 or whatever last cycle. And I think every cycle, the big guys will go down less. I think ETH came out stronger out of all this drama. Of course, it's going to suck and like we're going to bounce around Chop City for a while. But I don't know. I think ETH max pain downs in like the 70s percentages, but which will happen if the macro environment stays ugly. That's one thing people need to remember, right?
Yeah, that's certainly true. But also at the same time, we're seeing an acceleration of just like the biggest bear market signals as a result of this whole Terra thing. Like funds are blowing up, people are losing all their net worth. Like we're doing the suicide hotline thing on the pinned on top of subreddits. Like
Regulators.
regulators are coming in. Like these are all the same conversations and the happenings. Like right now, the suicide hotline is contained into one ecosystem. But like, dude, it was pinned across like many ICOs, like our cryptocurrency throughout all of 2018 and 2019. And this is where funds would blow up on leverage over and over and over again. And so like, I'm wondering if we just like brought some of the bear market pain forward a little bit because of this whole Luna crash ecosystem thing. Yeah, that's my take.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you. I think also, like, I had tweeted this the other day, but it seems like every freak out, quote unquote, bear market event to me is less and less systematically scary. Like, for me, I've witnessed four big ones. Like, Gox was the first one for me, and like, everyone thought that could be the end of Bitcoin. Then the DAO hack, everybody thought was the end of Ethereum. Then we had, like, you know, Black Thursday, where, oh shit, did we screw up this whole DeFi thing? And like, you know, it all going to zero. And to me, like, a Ponzi collapse thing, yeah, I get it. People lost a lot of money. I mean, I feel bad about that. But like, Ethereum itself is just not really affected by this. Like, funds blowing up does not affect the future of Ethereum, right? And that wasn't the case in like past, you know, collapses that we've seen.
Yeah. Yeah. Go for it, Anthony.
I think the current debate right now, at least in my circles, was May 2021 the start of the bear market? Was November 2021 the start of the bear market? Because people are saying, oh, well, the new all-time high in November was just a dead cap bounce. Yeah, we went to a new all-time high, but it was still technically, if you look at the chart, like a dead cap, right? And I can see both sides of this. So if you fall into like the May 2021 top camp, we've already been in a bear market for a year, right? But then if you fall into the November one, it's 6 months. I actually think the November one was driven by the macro environment going nuts, like its last hurrah before like all these Fed kind of rate rises and stuff kind of started coming out, right? And the really big inflation numbers. So I don't know where I sit on that one. I'm leaning more towards May being that kind of like top, because the thing is, we blew off really fucking hard in May, right? Within a week, we went down from 4.4K to 1700. Like, that was a massive blow off top. People got absolutely destroyed on leverage. We had a huge volume candle. Like, it was one of the biggest in history, right? So I think, if you're depending on what camp you fall on is kind of like, it determines like how you feel about the current market. Like, if we're going to stay at 1700 as the bottom, or if we're going to go to max pain triple digits, like that. So I agree with Eric. That's like max blood in the streets. You know, I would pull out all the stops to buy as much as I could at that price point. Right. But like, you know, I don't have much ammo left at this point. Just keep buying ETH, but prematurely.
Sell some of those figurines.
Yeah. Max,
I'm not sure about the liquidity on those markets right now.
Yeah. You might just start seeing the room get very bare, and like, because the ETH is in triple digits. But no, I think that's like, yeah, depending where you fall on that kind of like opinions spectrum, there is how you're going to feel about the current kind of market, I think.
Raul Paul, when we had our interview with him, gave a take that I think I'm leaning into, which is that inflation came from asset price appreciation. All the people that had assets in the stock market and crypto assets started buying a bunch of houses and just like being super price insensitive. And I heard some stat from some article, so of course it's true, that 1/5 of all mortgages in the United States in the year 2022 came from crypto wealth, or 2021 came from crypto wealth. So you know that like a lot of this asset appreciation is coming from just, or this inflation is coming from asset appreciation. So if you take that fact, the crash of the tech stocks, which were the big growers, and then the overall crash of the market and the crypto market is just killing demand, right? And so the source of inflation came from asset price appreciation. And now that we're back to like pre-inflation levels, Raul Paul thinks that the inflation is already dead, but since CPI is a lagging indicator, the Fed can't act on it because they have to wait for the verifiable like numbers to show up saying, yo, inflation's actually dead, even though it's already been dead for months. And like one very small anecdote that I've been thinking about lately is I'm moving to Brooklyn. And so I bought a bunch of patio furniture coming to San Diego to put on my patio and like relatively nice stuff. But like now I've got to sell it. And so I'm selling it 1 year used, and I have it like 50 to 70% off. And like, they're not going. I'm actually kind of stressed by it. And I don't know what to do with this shit. But like, yo, like 1 year old patio furniture, 50 to 70%, and no one's going for it. And so like, yo, demand's dead. Like, verifiable. Like, there's your data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just one anecdote, but verifiable data point. Yeah.
Don't get liquidated on your patio furniture. Yeah, it's fine. Oh, go ahead.
No, you go, Eric.
Okay. Now I was just gonna say, like, One, like going back to the markets a little bit, I think people are pointing to Luna as this collapse, which obviously was a factor, but it was like macro, the stock market was getting ugly to begin with. I think we were headed generally in this direction no matter what, and it just kind of accelerated. I mean, if you look at the S&P 500 graph, they've had six straight weekly red candles, which is like pretty unheard of for the S&P 500, right? But one of the funny things, like, you know, you go mainstream and like Wall Street Journal, CNBC, they're all talking about the great crypto crash. Meanwhile, like if you look at some of the stocks year to date, like PayPal's down 50% year to date, Netflix is down, Meta's down 40. Like there are a lot of tech stocks down more than ETH is from, you know, over the last 12 months or whatever. So that's a new paradigm for sure. That used to not happen. And that spooks me a little bit on the macro side, but also maybe the selling's wearing out, you know, at the same time.
A lot of those stocks also have wiped out like their entire pandemic gains. Like they're back to March 2020 prices, basically, whereas ETH is still up like over 20x since its bottom back then, right? So just looking at it like that, I think is amazing because everyone's like, oh, you know, crypto is like super volatile, super risky. Stocks are like where you need to be. I mean, okay, a lot of the long tail of crypto assets definitely just giga wrecked, like they're down 90%+, right? But like when I talk about crypto investing in it, I'm talking about like, you know, ETH, right? At the end of the day. So I think when you look at it like that, ETH is faring, you know, amazingly, which is quite a cool thing. And something to keep in mind, I think, for people as well. Like if people were in other assets that got destroyed in crypto, like I'm sorry, guys, but like that's just what happens every single time. Like, you know, you're speculating on things that are inherently worthless a lot of the time. They got no value accrual at all. Right, they got no value, like valueless governance token.
They're just new too, and so yeah, like those new people and get
super
scared.
Risky,
new,
right?
New holders.
Yeah, exactly, super risky, and like a lot of them also, what a lot of people forget is that they have early investors unlocking all the time, right, and dumping like huge amounts of tokens onto the market and liquidity mining programs, things like that. I mean, we all saw this play out already in DeFi summer. Like we learned our lessons, right? That's why I think, I don't know, I don't speak for you guys, but for myself, like I don't speculate on many of these tokens anymore. Like it's just, I know what ends up happening. They all have the same graph. Like it's just insane, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's natural for like the Coin Market Cap or now Coin Gecko, like the tokens, the further down the tokens are, the more the capital flies up, right? It flies up to the quality assets with the most liquidity that are the most stable. But over like, I think Bitcoin and Ether are down like the same percentage. I think Ether was down 65 and Bitcoin was down 64% from the top. Which is just fantastic in comparison to last cycle. Because I think
they're down Bitcoin... about the same right now, though. I think they got a little bit wrecked on that sell off there.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But like
the ratio chart is just priming for post merge breakout. I mean, it's like perfectly aligned for it.
I don't take opinionated positions very often. I usually just buy ETH, but I did. Put ETH into Compound, borrow Bitcoin, bought more ETH, and put that back into Compound to trade the merge. I did do that.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's coming. People are just sleeping. I mean, it's going on Robston, what, in a month or something like that? It was, they said on Encore Devs today. Yeah.
Approximately, yeah.
Yeah, so about a month. I mean, it's going to catch people, I think, off guard, just like Phase Zero launch did, just like 1559 did. Most people, like, I don't think this stuff's priced in. I don't think the market's educated enough to really understand it. And I think the one thing that's really going to catch people off guard is what the staking yields are going to look like once you add in transaction fees and MEV.
What do you think that number is going to be?
I've been estimating ballpark 15% to 20%, just randomly.
I think consensus has
but,
come down on that. I think consensus well, has settled around 7%.
Well, it depends. Well, it depends, right? Because I think, say we get up to 15%, people are going to flood it. So I think equilibrium will probably end up settling around where you're saying 7%, something like that. But early on, we might see before people kind of catch on to what it is. But it's tough to say. I haven't done any real number crunching on it.
Yeah, the numbers that came out to like 13 to like 17% a while ago were based on two assumptions. Like that was during DeFi summer when there was like 200 to 400 per like day grade prices. So a lot of just like transaction fees. But then all that estimation also came from a 70-30 base fee tip split, which was also hypothesized, and then kind of was true a little bit, but then kind of it's dwindled to the new equilibrium now, which is 90-10. And so there's 90% of a transaction fee goes to the base fee and only 10% goes to the tips. And so with the reduction of the gray price for gas prices as well, like the new like kind of consensus I've heard lately is like about 7% post-merge.
The one big thing I haven't seen good analysis around, I've asked on Twitter a little bit, just haven't got there, is what to expect on the MEV side. Like how much are miners truly pulling in on the MEV side right now? I don't know. It's hard to, I saw a couple links and it just was kind of complex to go try to calculate.
My gut take is that gets you back up to like 13 to 15%.
Right.
If you are the best MEV miner, I bet you get up to 13 to 15% again. You got to be doing some real shady shit.
Well, I mean, people are just going to release open source software to just run and you just basically take it, right? Kind of like Flashbots.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Well, there's also the dynamic that MEV actually doesn't stay on the layer one, and the layer one actually stays like relatively efficient with arbitrage, but the MEV actually moves up to the layer twos where there's a lot more transaction volume and a transaction demand. That's, I think Hazu gave that take. It's actually Kyle Samani gave that take, where layer twos eat up all the MEV, which, I mean, his claim was that it's bearish for the layer one, which I don't agree with at all. But I actually just think that's especially bullish for layer twos, though.
Fun fact, that was Optimism's initial profitability plan, was just take all the MEV themselves and be profitable
that's become like the new table stakes for all layer twos, is that you generate revenue from the layer two. But I think Optimism very quickly realized that, like, oh well, if we want to beat other layer twos, we have to basically incur all of this revenue into public goods, because that starts the feedback loop, right? And so like that was them going through their thinking process of the whole thing.
I think the layer two thing, like it's right, like they're gonna be the transactional layers, right? So they're gonna generate so much of this kind of like fee revenue and MEV and stuff, and I think the token in that sense makes sense because the token will be staked or something like that, and people run validators and sequences and things like that and earn fees like that. But the thing is that, and the point that Samani gets wrong here is that these layer twos have to pay Ethereum layer one, like in ETH, right? And that ETH, most of it gets burned, so it doesn't take away from the, and ETH is also the unit of account and like the money of these layer twos. Like it's not the native token of these layer twos isn't going to be the fee token for pretty much any of them. I know people point to Matic as being the fee token of the Polygon POS chain, but that was just like a byproduct of an old kind of design, and the POS chain is obviously not a layer two. So I think for their layer twos, they just use ETH, right? Matic will be the staking token, things like that. So same is true for pretty much all the layer two tokens, I think there. But yeah, I think the post-merge staking yields is hard to calculate because of the MEV component and how that's all going to shake out. But yeah, we could see 10%+ just based on that. And then as Eric said, we're going to see a flood of ETH come in like staking, because 10%+ near risk-free yield, pretty much risk-free yield on denominated in ETH. Like, come on. Like, I mean, you know, there's going to be a flood of kind of like people coming in for that, I think.
I think the last topic perhaps to talk about before we wrap things up here is how to get exposure to the merge that isn't with Ether. So there's like layer two tokens like Matic. There's two tokens on layer twos like the Lyra token or the Magic token. And then there's you're trying to farm airdrops themselves. There's Lido and Rocket Pool. Do you guys have any like thoughts on how to gain exposure to the merge without just like buying Ether? The obvious thing.
Eric, you go. You probably have different thoughts than me.
I would say personally, I would make plays on the infrastructure side of things. So I think right now it's still a little complex for people to enter, whether it's like Coinbase or running their own node. Like Coinbase isn't complex, but people don't want to put it on Coinbase. And I think people are really yet to hear about, say, like a Rocket Pool. I'll just use Rocket Pool as an example. I'm not like promoting them or whatever. And just, I own zero RPL tokens, so I have no incentive in saying this. But I think people are kind of waiting for the merge to happen. That's going to be like a huge news event, and people are going to flood in because of the yields and stuff. And, you know, Rocket Pool has been building for years, and all of a sudden people are going to say, hey, either I don't have 32 ETH, which is very understandable, or hey, I don't want to like worry about running this node infrastructure myself. And I think we're going to see a big push of ETH and users and popularity into a rocket pool or other infrastructure type plays that just make this easier for people, right? Because like, look, I'm running my own ETH2 phase zero nodes, but shit's complex. Like, it is not easy. Like, if my machine blows up, I got my private key somewhere, but recreating what I did, you know, 16 months ago is not the easiest thing in the world. And so I think that'll get better, but most people are going to want to just click a couple buttons, you know, via their MetaMask hardware wallet, whatever, and just stake and be done. So I think the popularity there is going to rise.
Anthony, what about you?
Yeah. Look, it's kind of like hard for me to say with respect to the tokens themselves, like LDO and RPL and things like that. Like, I do hold some of those. So just like, but they're not like a huge part of my portfolio. But I think ETH is just such a easy thing to bet on and such a shelling point, not just for people within crypto as kind of like a bet on the merge and on staking in general, but outside of crypto. Like, the big money outside of crypto is not going to be buying these staking tokens. They're going to be buying ETH if they buy anything, right?
Is your answer so, ETH after I told you it couldn't be ETH?
Yeah, no, I'm getting to my answer.
Wrapped ETH.
I'm getting to my answer. I think that when looking at tokens, it doesn't matter if it's a staking token or a DeFi token, whatever, you can't just look at like the narrative as anything more than a trade. Like, maybe these things will pump into the merge on the narrative, but then they're probably just going to bleed out. Like, if they do that, right? You can't. So when investing in tokens, you can't just look at one thing and be like, oh, I'm going to hold this thing for 3 years because it's a merge narrative. Like, no, you have to look at, you know, what's the distribution, what's the supply like, how much more tokens are coming to market, what's the value accrual, all that sorts of stuff. You can't just base a long-term investment on a narrative that's going to play out over a few months, right? So I think from that perspective, like, I'm just going to give ETH as my answer. I don't care if you said I can't give ETH. I'm giving ETH as my answer. Like, that's my answer. That's my final answer. Lock it in. That's it. So that's my view on betting on tokens, basically.
Oh, all right, guys. Eric, thanks for coming into the stream, man. It's good to see you.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for the invite. This is my first comeback in a while on any kind of podcast or video chat.
We need to do the ETH Hub podcast next week, man. We've been them hanging for too long.
We should probably get back on that, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder who's
not doing that.
Yeah. No, let's book it in. We're good. Cool.
All right, guys. Good stuff.
Cool. Thanks for stopping by, Eric. For the YouTube listeners, you guys know what to do. Like and subscribe and all that stuff. Here is Anthony's daily. Eric was like, I'm out. Here's Anthony's daily YouTube link to subscribe to that if you guys don't follow him. So thank you, everyone, for tuning into this semi-regular Friday Bankless Daily Guide live stream. We'll see you next time we do it. Bye, Anthony.
Thanks, everyone. Bye, everyone.